It's always interesting to me when I try to explain and help my kids to understand my job as a priest and like the ministry of the church and that sort of thing. And so I have a couple of fun examples along the way, which of kind of misunderstanding, which is the first, probably my favorite, is that for 2 years, my daughter Joanna thought that when we did baptisms, she called them bathtisms. Baptisms, which is actually like astute. Maybe we should call them baptisms. But she just thought that that's what they were called for a long time. But another one is that in the weeks leading up to my ordination, I could see that Joanna, this was years ago, so she was a lot younger, and she really didn't quite understand what we would talk about in the weeks and days leading up to the ordination. And so she seemed genuinely kind of intrigued and excited, but you could tell, you know, when you could just tell she wasn't really getting it. And so we tried to explain to her that, you know, there's going to be a service, a special service at church just for daddy, you know, and to celebrate something that daddy's done, and all the family and friends are going to be there, and there'll be robes and stoles, you know, and she just kind of furrowed brow most of the time. But she also, it was odd because along with that kind of skepticism and misunderstanding, there was like, seemed to be a genuine, like, she was kind of impressed with me, I think, which you parents know, that's a hard thing to create sometimes with your kids. And so, well, it finally all clicked for us the day of my ordination when she came into our room in the morning and said, "Daddy, wake up, it's your coronation day." I don't know what exactly she imagined, you know, that I was going to be crowned king or prince of some group of people. Needless to say, she ended up being very unimpressed by the whole affair. I think she had something much grander in mind. Well, our story this morning is not about a coronation, but it is close. It's close. Our story of Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem as people waved palms and shouted Hosanna, this is a story about royalty, about kings. So let those images this morning, those images of royalty, you know, crowns and robes and parades and, you know, I don't know, hats. Do they wear hats? I don't know. Like, you know, just let those like royal images kind of flood your mind this morning because it's appropriate for our text, all right? Now, it's important to know that the context of this story, you know, at this point in Jesus' life, when he marches into Jerusalem, things have gotten to a boiling point. You know, Jesus was very guarded through much of his life. You might remember stories where he would like do something really spectacular, a miracle of some kind, and then he would say, "Hey, but let's keep this between us. You know, don't go shouting it from the rooftops." You know, he was flying under the radar in many ways. And so he's keeping it kind of isolated. Groups of people were learning about who he was and what he does, but he had not gone public yet until now. In this story, he does something, he does things, and he allows things to be done to him, for him, that he had previously not let people do. The time was now. You hear many stories in the Bible, in Jesus' life, about him saying, "The time isn't yet. This isn't the time." Well, now is the time. Jesus is going public. And so there are some powerful images here in this story, and I want to look at three this morning. The song, the donkey, and the palms. Jenny, for what it's worth, wanted me to call the second point the ass, but I said no. But now it's going to be the only thing that you hear when I say donkey. I know that, but the song, the donkey, and the palms, all right? So let's start with the song. The text tells us that as Jesus enters the city, that people break out into song, shouting and singing a psalm to him. I'm going to verse 37 here rereading that. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." Now that song is pretty impressive in and of itself, but they're actually quoting something there. They're referring to an Old Testament psalm, Psalm 118, the one that we just read responsively on the screen there. So it's like it's a callback from something ancient, from their past. And that psalm, Psalm 118, has some powerful context to it that I think I need to unpack with you a little bit. In the same way that, like, if a visitor to earth came and you sang a song like, "We Shall Overcome," you wouldn't get all the richness of what that song means without explaining to that being, slavery and oppression and injustice and freedom and equality. Like, you can't understand the power of that song without giving a lot of context. In the same way, when the people that day sang out, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord," it carried this deep, rich context for them. It was a song about a long-awaited king. So I want to talk about that history with you a little bit, because so much of the history of God and his people involves a king, involves royalty, a king or a queen. Going all the way back to the very beginning, the Bible tells us that at the very beginning of time, at the very beginning of humanity, we stood before a perfect king, a great king. And that we rebelled against that king, and the king let us walk away from his perfect reign. We were sent out of the garden, and his kingdom began to fall apart. A story then began being told that someday someone will come back and take that rightful place as king of all of humanity. It's a story that is on every page of the Bible, practically. There are hundreds of stories in the Old Testament about that dynamic, hoping, longing for a king. God's people putting person after person after person onto the throne. Will this one do? Is this the king that we need? Maybe he or she will satisfy this longing that we have to be perfectly ruled. Needless to say, it goes terribly for humanity. Why? Because human beings don't make very good kings. Even when they don't become tyrants and plunge everyone into poverty and despair, it doesn't satisfy that longing in the human heart for a perfect king and a perfect kingdom. Now, before you kind of discount that idea as like, an American, and say like, no, like, I don't long for a king. Like, I'm an American. We've asked and answered that question. Like, we love, our democracy. We rule ourselves, Before you go too far, I would say not so fast. Not so fast. I think that longing for a king still lives in every heart. It's not just a Bible hope. It's a humanity hope. Let me give just a few examples. First, currently, there are not like a ton of royal families left in the world, but aren't they among like the most gigantic of stars to the world? Like just the infatuation with kings and princes and little royal babies and royal weddings and all that stuff. People go bonkers, right? There's still this like connection and a longing for that kind of world. We're still drawn to those royal figures. Additionally, royal stories are all around us. They're some of the most popular stories that have ever been told. From Lord of the Rings to Narnia, two of like the, arguably the most notable, significant fictions of the last century, to modern times. Like, do you know what the top grossing movie was of 2018? John knows. Black Panther. Black Panther is a story about a king. King T'Challa, I think. And his, like, wrestling for the throne of his kingdom. And it's a story about who will be king, who ultimately will sit on that throne, and what should the king be like? What should the kingdom be marked by? That's last year. This year, in 2019, I was just kind of just thumbing around, seeing, is this really true? Are the king stories still super prevalent among us? And I think they are. This year, there are two gigantic anticipated kids movie reboots. One is Aladdin, a story about a king, about a diamond in the rough who is like trying to find his place and ultimately get to the place of sultan of the kingdom. That story even has, I was thinking this week, it even has like a triumphal entry moment, doesn't it? Remember like the Prince Ali song, you know, as he comes into town and there's this conflicted sense of really who this person is. The other kids movie, by the way, that's coming out this year as a reboot is Lion King, you know? These stories are still everywhere. Now, is it because the Judeo-Christian story has like projected itself onto every story and kind of forced its way into every culture? Or is it because this story, the story for the longing of an anticipated king, a perfect ruler, someone worthy of not just our allegiance, but of our hearts and lives, maybe that story is woven into every heart. Maybe that's why we love those stories so much. I could say more, of course, about how we still try to crown people in our modern lives, you know, the way that we take politicians or celebrities and like make them kings. Someone that gets more than just our vote, but they get our hope. The way that we treat celebrities in this culture, we're still longing for a king because the human heart yearns for one. I find that image of that like longing for a king to be helpful like in my personal life too. You and I think, I would argue, put a lot of things, a lot of people on the throne of our lives, if you will. Trying things on, putting them on the throne, saying, will this work? Will this satisfy? Will this be able to really rule me? Can I serve this thing with not just my time, but with my entire life? And if I do, will it satisfy me? We, just like the old people of Israel, put thing after thing after thing on the throne, hoping maybe this will be it. You know, our career, our kids, our stuff, our morality, we put it on the throne, and then when it fails to be a good king to us, the perfect king that we long for, then we despair. The hope for a king, a perfect ruler, lives in the human heart, and it was alive and well in Jesus' day, that day when Jesus rode into Jerusalem. When they sang that song, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. They were saying, this is our king. This is our guy. Not just this is a king, not just this is, you know, this is the next person in a long line of disappointing kings. This song, the Psalm 118, was written about the king, the one that would really, you know, build the perfect kingdom and restore the world. They were singing that song about Jesus. He's the one, the real king, the one that all history had pointed to, the one that all humanity had waited for, the one who would restore his perfect kingdom. And they were right. They were right about it. They didn't quite know how right they were. He was the one true king. Hey, Jenny, can I get some water there, my water? I have like allergies and my mouth is so dry. Thank you. Point two, the one you've been waiting for. the donkey. It seems odd, doesn't it, how much real estate, like textually, is given to the acquiring of the donkey, doesn't it? It's long. It's like five verses in a pretty short story. I'll read it for you. As they approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' say, 'The Lord needs it.'" Then, so it tells you his instructions, and then it goes ahead and tells you the entire narrative over again. Those who were sent ahead went and found it just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, "Why are you untying the colt?" They replied, "The Lord needs it." Why so much real estate to the acquiring of the donkey? Why is the donkey so important? Why so much emphasis? It doesn't say donkey explicitly in the story, by the way. It says colt, but we learn from the other accounts that it's a donkey's colt, a young donkey, not a young horse. Okay, Jesus wants a very young donkey to ride into town on for his big parade into town. Why? Why would Jesus do this? Why would he, for his triumphal announcement as king, ride into town on a small donkey? That is not what kings do. Kings ride in on majestic steeds, on war horses, you know? Can you imagine that conversation between Jesus and the disciples, by the way? Like, if it filled out a little more space, you know, where Jesus was saying, like, "Guys, it's time. We are going to Jerusalem." And the disciples would say, "Oh, Jesus, like, that's really dangerous. That's where the opposition is, you know." And Jesus would say, "No, we're going, and it's going to be big. And everyone is going to lose their minds and be singing our praises. They're going to proclaim me as king." And they are just like, yes. The disciples are like, "This, yes, finally, Jesus, this is what we've been talking about. We've been saying you should do something like this," you know. They're so jazzed up. And Jesus says, "Okay, great, I just need you to do one thing for me. I need you to get me a donkey to ride into town on." At which point, I'm sure the disciples just fell apart. You know, like, "Are you kidding me? Jesus, no. Jesus, king, Jesus, riding into town, a horse. Jesus, your image, you need help." Like, you're not displaying the right, you know, "You're a king, Jesus." And Jesus says, "Oh, I know exactly what I'm doing. I know exactly what I'm doing. I want a small donkey." He's showing us something here, that he's not just the king, but what kind of king he is. "I'm not coming," Jesus is saying, "with the kind of power that you think. If I were to come in power," I think Jesus would say, "I would be able to bring a little bit of freedom for a relatively small group of people. But if I come on a donkey, like if I come in weakness, I can bring total freedom for all people. If I come not bearing a sword, but bearing your sins, I'm coming to die. Yes, to rule, but first to die. And that's not less powerful, it's more. You think that you know what kind of king you need, but you don't. I am the kind of king you need, the kind of king that rides into town on a donkey, a king carrying with him weakness and grace and love and forgiveness, not force and coercion. I will make the way," Jesus is saying, "for forgiveness for all the sins that you've ever committed. I'll deal with the guilt and shame that live in your heart, the brokenness and disappointment, and that longing even that every human heart has for that fulfillment of a real good king. I'm going to satisfy that to you. I'm going to live there in your hearts. And someday I'll restore the entire kingdom, the entire world. And not only will I give you kind of peace instead of war, or prosperity instead of poverty, I will bring a kingdom where there is no more sickness and no more pain and no more tears and no more death forever. But in order to accomplish those things, I have to come in weakness, not in power. As a servant, not as a warrior. You can trust me, Jesus is saying. I'm gentle and lowly in spirit. I come not on a powerful horse, but on a young donkey. One last thing about the donkey. The text tells us that this donkey was so young that it's never been ridden before. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with those kind of animals, but I hear that a animal like that has never been ridden before, it's not so easy to just like throw a blanket on it and hop on it and say, hey, we're going to Jerusalem, you know? That's my understanding. I think that animals like that generally have to be like trained and broken, as they say. Yet here this animal is that has never been ridden, and it acts like it has been created for this purpose, to take Jesus into Jerusalem. Commentators say that there's a subtle point being made here about that, like that it hasn't been ridden before, and here it is carrying Jesus. That everything in creation was made to serve the king. The donkey was created for this purpose, service to the king. In fact, it kind of comes up again in a way at the end of the passage when the Pharisees criticize Jesus and they say, Jesus, tell your disciples to stop saying this. And Jesus says, you know, if they do, the rocks will cry out. Jesus is saying everything has been created to serve the king. We too were created for a life of service to the one true king. So not only does that true king make a difference for our eternity, forgiving our debts and assuring us of our salvation, he makes a difference for our now too. When we serve him, we find ourselves doing what we were created to do. Last point, the palms. I find the palms to be a bit of a, you know, cultural disconnect, of course. Most of you, I noticed, you know, we kind of just wave them around, these little leaves, you know, awkwardly. Some of you, I saw you, were even, like, too cool to even, like, pick up the palm. I was watching, okay? It's true. It feels weird, doesn't it? Why does it feel weird? Because that's not how we praise someone, exalt someone now. I don't know exactly what the cultural equivalent would be for us now. I think about things like the World Series parade. You know, some of you are probably there. If not, you can imagine that environment, like shouting, screaming, hurling praise on these players that had secured us the title. Or the kind of eruption that happens in Arrowhead Stadium when St. Patrick Mahomes is announced, you know, like people go crazy. That's what like our equivalent of praising someone looks like. That's how we do it with wahoos and adult drinks, you know, that's our version. But in Jesus's day, it was palms. That's how they praised someone. They waved their palms. They sang his praise. They ran up to the front of the parade route, you know, and laid their palms down in the path that Jesus was coming. I imagine them, like, especially kids like these, running up and setting their palms down, maybe catching eyes with Jesus just for a second as he marched into town. I guess my point here is that it wasn't just a song that day, like kind of a declaration of something that was true about God, about Jesus. And it wasn't just about fanfare that day, the donkey and the parade, you know. What we see in this story is something deeply personal that's happening for these people. Real people crying out with their hearts, waving their hands and their palms in the air, not just saying, this is the king, but this is my king. This is my king. A real king like this requires a response. We have to respond to him in some way, you know, and we see a couple of those responses in the text. You see the Pharisees, they kind of critique, you know, and you can imagine people kind of standing at a distance, and then there are people that are right up front, waving palms and shouting his praises. Jesus wants you to treat him as a king. So if your allegiance is torn, if you're still trying on different things into the throne, then you aren't really treating him as your king. If you aren't obeying him, a dedicated and loyal subject to his will, then you aren't really treating him as your king. If you aren't serving him, sacrificing your reign for his, then you aren't treating him as king. And he is inviting all of us this morning to treat him as a king. Not just as a teacher, although he is that. Not just as a gentle comforter for our pain, which he is that. Not just for a perfect judge, taking away all of our guilt, although he is that too. Jesus is saying to you this morning, I am your king. I've come to satisfy the longings of your heart. So worship me, serve me, obey me, love me. I'm your king. I want to invite us to stand just a second. I'll have you stand up in a second. This isn't in the program. It's not in the bulletin. It's just something Lindsay and I were talking about. I think that God asks something of us this morning, and that's to treat him as king. He wants our hearts. So I want to just stand and sing. We're just going to sing one song here. And this time, forget about the palms, will you? Just leave those on your chair and give him your heart this morning in worship. Sing this song and sing it out. And if it helps you to like praise Jesus as your king, then raise your hands. If not, then don't. If you aren't a singer, then just pray in your heart, Lord, I'm so grateful for all that you've done for me, and I worship you, and I give you all of my life and all of my heart this morning. Whatever it looks like for you, respond to Jesus this morning as your king.